Good morning. Finally starting to heat up a little bit outside, may get up above freezing today. Somebody said, where is global warming when we really need it? Yeah. A couple of quick announcements. On Monday, February 12th at 11 o'clock in this room, General David Barno will be here. David Barno commanded the American troops, the occupation forces, in Afghanistan from 2003 to 2005. And he's going to be here to talk about conducting counterinsurgency operations in Afghanistan. And then next Friday, February 16th at 10 o'clock, we'll be having a program on oil and foreign policy. That will start at 10 o'clock. Among those who will be participating are Edward Morse, who is the chief oil economist for Lehman Brothers, Joe Barnes from the Baker Institute for Public Policy at Rice, and several others. So those who are interested in trying to figure out what the world oil markets hold for us should plan to come next Friday. But let me welcome you all to the Miller Center Forum. We're delighted that you're here today, and delighted especially to welcome Dr. Robert Kayat. Dr. Kayat actually started out as a lawyer and as a football player. He received his education at Ole Miss. He played football for the Washington Redskins, where he was a kicker, got his law degree at Yale, and now is the 15th chancellor of the University of Mississippi. He was appointed in 1995, and among many other accomplishments, he is responsible for establishing the Phi Beta Kappa chapter at Ole Miss. Reverend Edward A. Malloy, who goes by the nickname Monk, served 18 years as president of the University of Notre Dame. He retired on July 1st, 2005, but now has emeritus status there and still lives in one of the student dormitories. During his tenure, he grew the endowment to over $5 billion, which is now 18th largest among U.S. private colleges and universities. He is a professor in the Department of Theology. He's been a member of the faculty there since 1974, and he played basketball. The topic of the importance of intercollegiate athletics in today's environment is an important one. Please join in welcoming Robert Kayat and Reverend Edward Malloy. While they are getting settled, also I wanted to pay particular welcome to some student athletes from the University of Virginia who are here in the rear of the room. These are all folks who regularly put in many, many extra hours preparing to represent the University of Virginia, and at least one of them I've had as a student, Kevin Cole, who's a lacrosse player, and I can tell you that he was a crackerjack, is still a crackerjack student. So we're very proud of all of you and glad you're here today. Gene Cargan, who is seated in the front of the group of student athletes, was athletic director at Notre Dame and also commissioner of the ACC. And Gene and I actually became friends 30-some years ago playing ice hockey together. And finally, one of the all-time greatest football players from the University of Virginia, who held many rushing records, is also here with us in the third row, Frank Quayle. Dr. Kayat will start the discussion.
Thank you, sir. Thank you, and good morning. George, I appreciate your having me here today and giving me an opportunity to share this podium with Father Malloy. Thanks to each of you all for coming. I especially appreciate my Mississippi friends, Dan and Lou Jordan and John and Renee Grisham, for being with us. We had fairly detailed instructions from George. I would like to read one of the sentences which you'll find relevant. Brevity is not only the soul of wit, but also the hallmark of a good question and a good answer. That was not lost on me, that's okay? I have to begin with a confession. I am an advocate of college athletics. I am concerned about some of the abuses that all of us read about from time to time or hear about. But I believe on balance that the benefit of college athletics to our society, especially the opportunities presented to young people, far outweigh the inappropriate behavior that we occasionally we observe coming from coaches or players or alums or fans. Now, we have serious challenges, but we have good people like Gene Corrigan who devote their lives to athletics and to the preservation of athletics in a form that we know it should be. For me, I'm from Moss Point, Mississippi, a little town on the Mississippi Gulf Coast. This would be, although I'm 68 years old, a defining moment to be at the University of Virginia with Father Malloy and with you all talking about a subject that's fairly serious and important to our country. And I have one other defining moment in my life that I like to tell audiences who are interested in sports, and it occurred in 1960 at a time in our history when the college all-stars played the National Football League championship team in at Soldier Field in Chicago called the College All-Star Game. And 36 college kids were selected to go to Northwestern University, train for 3 weeks, and then play the NFL champions. My year, it was the Baltimore Colts. And our coaches, people like Otto Graham, who some of you all remember, were aware that we were seriously outmatched, that the pros were likely to be better than we were. And so they had two of us at each position, and I was a guard. And I had an alternate, a wonderful young man from another part of the country. And our plan was that he would play the first quarter, and I would play the second quarter, and he'd play the third, and I'd play the fourth. And that way we'd get through the evening. It turned out that we received the kickoff, and my alternate tried to block a man named Sherman Plunkett, who played tackle for the Colts and weighed just over 300 pounds and was quite quick and could run. And he ran right through my alternate. And as you might imagine, I'm sitting on that sideline in that big stadium with those lights and television cameras, first event for me like that, and I'm watching my alternate, and he doesn't get up. He starts crawling. He gets on all fours, and if you ever sold your field before they enclosed it, there was a deep end zone that just stayed open, and it was dark, and my man just kept crawling. That's the guy. Into the darkness. Never came back. been what, 47 years since I've seen him. So good boy that I was, I jumped up, ran in the huddle, and Don Meredith, who some of y'all remember was our quarterback, and he called the play, and I ran out the line of scrimmage. I'm just about the same size I am now. I line up, and I look across the line of scrimmage, and I see this sternum. All I can see is this. I'm looking right here at this man, and it's got big 76 on it. His name's Eugene Lipscomb. And he was known as Big Daddy Lipscomb, and for good cause. He was about 6'7 or 6'8, weighed about, he said 285, but he weighed about 315. He was 33 or 34, 35 years old, had that big cage on his face, had a big beard. And I'm standing there on Soldier Field, and I'm looking up at him, and he's looking down at me, and it's like when you're in an automobile accident and the frame frame just freezes. You just stop. And so help me goodness, he said, "Boy, does your mama know that you're out here tonight?" And for me, that was a defining moment. I decided on the spot that I was going to law school, that I was not going to spend my life with Mr. Lipscomb. Who, by the way, proceeded to give me a nice little whipping that night and called me Sweet Pea. When Jimmy Carter was elected president, Time magazine did an issue, a special issue on the South, and they had a section on sports. And here is the way that article began. It is a September Saturday morning, and the tribes have begun to move. The interstate highways that lace the South start to clog up with a glut of cars, campers, and $25,000 motorhomes with beds, baths, color TVs, and banner streaming antennas. Citizen band radios howl with rebel yells, chants, and incantations. Eat 'em up, dogs. Get 'em, gators. Roll Tide. The college football season has arrived. Everyone who could ferret a ticket is going to the game. Which the game? It doesn't matter. The South is renewing its annual passion, and every game is the game. And I think that those words, although they were written in 1976, may be understated today, but it's pretty much the same passion, expresses the same passion that people in this country, not just in the South, have for college athletics. I'm one who believes that it's a unique and significant part of our culture, that you look at a television screen or you go to a stadium or a basketball arena and you see size and muscle and facial hair and tattoos, and they look just like the people you see on Sunday or Wednesday night on TNT or something playing in the NBA, but they're not the same. They're 18 years old, many of them, 18 to 22 years of age, and they're making this transition from childhood to adulthood. So there's a different sort of person on the field or on the court in a college athletics contest. A second distinguishing factor is that games are played and matches are played on college campuses. And I think we would agree that in our society, there's no place quite like a college campus. And there's something about it. We're tied to it emotionally. We come back to it. We feel good. We remember when we were students. And so there's that feeling of homecoming, coming home. Each year, unlike the professional leagues, each year, new freshmen, young people come in, 18-year-olds, and graduates or people who finish their careers leave. And so there are no 10-year veterans. There's a new crop every year, the fresh new faces. The spectacle of a football game at a place like South Bend on a beautiful Saturday afternoon with the green and gold and the band and the cheerleaders and the pep squads and the young people and the older folks, there's something truly spectacular about that and unique and different. And it just is, in my opinion, easily distinguished from other forms of athletics in our country and worthy of preservation. Once I had an opportunity to go to a basketball game where Kansas played Iowa State. And that's a very different experience from going to the FedEx Forum in Memphis to watch the Grizzlies play. Totally different. So I think it's unique. I think it's worth preserving. The way our society feels about it probably is measured easily by numbers. 45 million people last year bought tickets to football games. 400,000 student athletes participated in sports at NCAA institutions. 29 communities sponsored bowl games for football. The industry has developed around, college athletics. And it's reflected everywhere from the merchandise in the stores to the television trucks that come in on Wednesday or Thursday for a game. 31 million people went to basketball games, and the NCAA is in the third year of a $6 billion television contract with CBS to broadcast the Final Four. And the Final Four, by the way, started as four, I think, and then eight, and then 16, and then 32, and then 64, and now it's 65. So if you're thinking about whether or not there's any interest in it, it just keeps growing. The frequently asked question, and one that George asked us to address today, is what is the role of college athletics in a university? And my comments have to be based on the University of Mississippi. And I see it first, and having been one, a college scholarship athlete, it creates opportunities for students to go to school to pursue degrees. Secondly, an athletics department, I'm sure at Notre Dame and at our place as well, at Ole Miss, is what we call an auxiliary. It's self-supporting. We don't put educational funds into athletics. The third really strong feature that I see of athletics is it builds community. It brings people to the campus. It reinforces relationships that have existed for many, many years. A fourth would be the exposure beyond your campus, beyond your state, beyond your region, really beyond the bounds of the nation that come to a university as a result of athletics. And then finally, the revenue generation of a successful and productive and well-balanced athletics program is important to the university. And then I have one little personal positive. I think about it, and I think about the dreamers. And I watch those kids on our campus who are 5 to 8 years old, who are 10 or 12, and they're throwing footballs, and they're wearing Eli Manning's jersey, and they're dreaming about what might be out there in the future for them. And it seems to me that dreams are important and that we ought to hang on to our dreams. The truth is that entire enterprise has become a major slice of our gross national product. And we have to guard it and protect it if we believe it's valuable, and it seems to me that we do. I see as the two primary threats to athletics, commercialization and the erosion of academic integrity to accommodate successful athletics teams. The basic scenario that I play out in my head is the president of the university or the director of athletics says, "Coach, we'd like to have you come coach for us, and we're going to pay you $1 million a year for 10 years to be our football coach or basketball coach." And the coach says, "Boy, that's a lot of money, and I have an opportunity to make it. Now, what do I have to do that?" And of course, I have to win. How am I going to win? I've got to get the best players, the best coaches, and the best facilities. How am I going to do that? And that's where the ethics line gets drawn, right there. It's how am I going to put a winning, competitive team on the court or on the field? Am I going to play by the rules of the NCAA and by my conference or by my university? Or am I going to do what I have to do to win so I can continue to make that money and be a celebrity and have the TV cameras on me on Saturday afternoon or Wednesday night and become so familiar that I'm a household name? And so the commercial forces that are at work, and they really do start on the playgrounds of the metropolitan areas and the game fields of the rural areas, the commercial forces start to work with agents and shoe companies and people like that. So that's one risk. The second one is the protection of the academic integrity of the school. And it's easy to see a university drift into something called general studies, or courses that don't really have a lot of substance to them. And it's easy to become cynical about it. And so what those of us who work in higher ed must do is be guardians of that intellectual academic integrity. At the same time, we have to be realist about what athletes are prepared to do when they finish their years in college. There is a compelling need in America for coaches. In our little state of Mississippi, there are 5,000 coaching positions in place right now in Mississippi. Municipalities and counties and districts everywhere have recreational programs. So we really need to train people who can work in the world of physical fitness and in coaching. And I can't think of a better group than athletes. And so one of our challenges, I think, is to try to balance the commitment to academic integrity with access for the student athletes and preparation for some sort of meaningful career after they complete their college careers. I now defer to Monk Malloy.
I had the privilege of being one of the speakers at Robert Kiat's inauguration as chancellor at the University of Mississippi, and it was one of the great thrills of my life, so I'm glad we're back on the podium together. Just a word about this name, Monk. A lot of people think, because I'm a priest, that it's a title like abbot or something. They kind of bow, Monk. But it really is a nickname I got in the fourth grade by a guy named Bunky Colley, and that's a whole nother story, but it has nothing to do with religion. And I find the only people that are not comfortable with giving me a nickname had nicknames like Fatso and Shorty and stuff like that when they were kids, which they wanted to leave behind. Both Robert and I are insiders, in a sense, because we came through the system. We were student athletes in grade school and high school and college, and he went on to the pros. I went on to the seminary, which is another story, but we know what it's like to be recruited, the kind of ego thrill with having coaches calling you up and sending you letters, and now with the forms of internet communication, it's even more overwhelming. But that can lead to a kind of distortion in your sense of self-worth. We know what it's like to be idolized by your fellow school members and others, adults who want to be connected to success. We know what it's like to have great coaching, but we also know, either directly or indirectly, what it's like to have a tyrannical coach who tries to dominate and take over your life. We know what it's like to experience straightforwardly the thrill of victory and the agony of defeat. Both Robert and I, I'm sure, could give a long talk about the values of athletic participation. He suggested some things: discipline, hard work, pulling together with your teammates for a common goal, learning how to be resilient in the face of sometimes lack of success, working your way through the system, coming in as a first-year student, and then the responsibility that goes along with being a senior. One of the things that I think coming from within the system allows you to do is to be a realist. On one hand, we can espouse the virtues of athletic competition, and on the other hand, we recognize that it can give a distorted and a false sense of reality. Nothing is worse, in my experience, than the disinterested president or chancellor in a university like ours. Because if the chancellor or president is not interested, someone else moves in to take over that role. But there's not a virtue in being overly interested either, being a cheerleader on the sideline, making your whole agenda during your chancellorship revolve around success in athletic competition. The president or chancellor role in a complex institution is, in my experience, a fun one most of the time, but it's full of precarious activities of one kind or another. It could revolve around the Greek system, or just student behavior that one can't directly control. It could be about faculty misconduct, or the way in which teaching and research and scholarly contributions of one kind or another strike some balance in terms of our overall responsibilities. It's about fundraising. It's about alumni relations. It's about keeping the faculty happy and the students sensing this is a great place to be during the prime years of their life, and so on. Athletics is just a part of that. Even though sometimes it dominates the news, you can't let yourself become so distracted by the athletic issues of the day that you lose your sense of responsibility for the rest of the enterprise. The heart of the enterprise is the academic learning and scholarship that goes on there and the contribution that makes to the common well-being. So it's really important for presidents, I think, who have been experienced in athletics themselves, to offer a kind of word of encouragement to those who have not, that you can learn about it just like you learn about hospitals, or you learn about refined research techniques, or you learn about investment strategies, even though you didn't come out of those worlds. Now, the role and responsibility of the president or chancellor is a distributed role. We have the executive responsibility. We have to pay attention to what goes on. We need to set the standards. We need to hold people accountable. But the governing board has its responsibility as well for policy, for oversight, not for excessive involvement. In my experience, and I'm on a lot of university and college boards, the great challenge for board members is not to take things they're inherently interested and rush and volunteer to be involved in them. They need to maintain their distance so that they can be objective in the judgments they make. But the role of the president in the daily action of athletics usually revolves around the athletic director and the athletic staff. That's a very critical choice. You have to share the same value set. And when the athletic director hires other athletic director assistants and coaches, they need to spend a lot of time and have a good judgment and good common sense. Because so much of what we do is one step removed, and the people who are in the field, so to speak, have to be responsible for the daily activity and the priority setting from moment to moment. But there's also a faculty board. On some campuses, the faculty are deeply interested and involved in athletics. In others, they're not. There needs to be a balancing in that structure of oversight. Some campuses do it well. Some campuses have done it poorly. And if any of the oversight functions fail, the whole campus suffers. The NCAA is an organization that sometimes gets maligned. But it's a membership organization. If it didn't exist, we'd have to find something comparable to replace it. It has a huge book of regulations, any one of which could get you in trouble. The reason the book is so big is because in the history of intercollegiate athletics, people have tried to beat the system by all kinds of strange devices of one kind or another. The reason we have a big book is it's trying to outwit those who want to beat the system. The NCAA, in my judgment, overall does a good job. The present head of the NCAA is a former college president at Indiana U most recently. And he has brought to the job a sense of recognition of the complicated reality of our college and university campuses, the distributed system, and so on. So I simply want to say the NCAA has a role to play, just like the on-campus actors do as well. In my time, the most dramatic change in intercollegiate athletics, the two, integration, an opportunity for people of various racial and ethnic backgrounds to show what they can do on the field in coaching positions and in administrative positions. And that's still a huge challenge for intercollegiate athletics as a whole. And the second great change and transformation is the presence of women and women's athletics, coeducational opportunities, much of which was driven by legal challenge, but now I think really makes our college and university athletic activities a very exciting and more representative cross-section of our community. I've been involved at Notre Dame in winning our teams winning a lot of different kinds of national championships. But none was more exciting for me than when our women's basketball team won the national championship for the first time, because our coach grew the program from 100 spectators to over 6,000 per game, which is about 10th nationally. So I've seen a program over 20 years grow to be a vital part of what goes on our campus, and that's true in general. One of the things that we have to worry about is the influence between professional athletics and the Olympic opportunities, what goes on in the collegiate realm, high school and grade school. If they're misbehaving in the pro or college ranks, it quickly segues down to the younger age groups. If they're using drugs here in order to build their bodies to a disproportionate size to be more competitive, the pressure exists all the way down the line. If they're gambling here on these kind of sports, they want to gamble on these kind of sports. We have a responsibility to look at the whole spectrum of athletic activity and to recognize sometimes the dire influence that can take place. And the last point, it's hard to imagine, if you go back 50 years, what it means to have pervasive talk sports radio, talk sports television, blogs, homepages, and interactive groups that want to review constantly with up-to-date information how recruiting is going, what you think of the coach, what you would have done on that play instead of that idiot that we have in charge of things. This is a volatile environment where people are hyper-interested in what goes on in intercollegiate athletics. And we have to pay close attention not only to how we present ourselves, but how that network of communication influences what we do. I look forward to our conversation.
I'm going to go to the back of the room, and I would ask those who have questions to meet me back there, and we have about 30 minutes, so we should be able to address a number of questions. But as I move to the back of the room, I'd like to pose a question to each of our speakers, and that is, what have each of you said to your booster organizations about the standards that you wish them and the people involved in the athletics program to maintain?
When I became president, I thought I inherited a wonderful set of expectations at my university for what the role of intercollegiate athletics should be. And Gene Corrigan, sitting back there, was very much involved in the implementation of that. But I thought the time had come when we needed to articulate in print what we expected of every segment of our university community, including booster organizations. That's been refined several times since then. So I think we have stated clearly and with force what we expect of our student athletes, our coaches. We expect our coaches to be part of the teaching faculty, for example. We expect our administrators to be aggressive in making sure that we abide by the rules and that we have academic integrity. And the booster clubs are simply a support mechanism.
When I became chancellor of my university, we were on NCAA probation for recruiting violations in the football program. And so the message had been received very well among our people that misbehavior was not going to be tolerated. And to a great extent, we've done the same things that Father Malloy has just described. We have an intensive educational program for our students. Every time we have a boosters meeting, part of the presentation has to do with relationships that are appropriate and inappropriate, and it's really not complicated. The rule is alumni and supporters have no contact with prospects, period. That's easy, not complicated. So we've tried to do pretty much the same thing that Notre Dame has done, but it is a never-ending battle, and to a great extent because of the exchange of information that Father Malloy talked about and the high level of interest and emotion that boosters of athletics really do have.
George, thank you. I want to ask you to you observe now the life of a student athlete, and how about comparing what you see now for the student athlete with your experience 40 years ago?
Of course, it's totally different. Nutrition is different. Physical preparation is different. The level of exposure is just so different because television is so pervasive. It seems to me that there has been a serious increase, substantial increase in the amount of leisure wealth and leisure time. And people are heavily invested, people being fans, in the whole athletics enterprise. The athletes who come to school, as Father Malloy mentioned, now about half of our athletes are women. In basketball and track and football programs, probably 85 to 90% of our athletes are African American. And so the demographics of college athletics have changed dramatically since the 50s and 60s when I was playing. I think the quality of the performance is much greater. The time devoted to athletics has increased dramatically. There's less time, even though the NCAA has worked very hard to restrict practice hours. Today's athletes are thinking about the weight room and the film room and the practice field a lot of every day. And so this balance that we keep trying to strike is a serious challenge and something that seems to be intensifying as the commercialization that I mentioned continues to grow.
One of the big changes that I would reflect about is how hard it is to extricate yourself from the social group that is your team with all of the expectations that go along with that. When I came through Notre Dame as an undergraduate basketball player, I lived in a student dormitory. We still require student athletes, except they can ask for permission the senior year to move out of a dorm. But that's one thing, to have them live in a dorm, but to actually participate in the normal social interactions of the dorm, time-wise, is extremely difficult. And then we construct facilities to make it easier for them to work out or to get academic counsel or whatever, and that isolates them more and more just because of the sheer amount of available time. So I think there is that whole thing. Then it's very difficult in a lot of the more highly visible sports to take a certain set of majors because of when labs are offered or other kinds of requirements for the course. Hard to be an engineer, hard to be an architect, hard to be pre-med. So in a sense, what you do, especially in the high-profile sports, is you eliminate certain sets of possible career options simply by being a student athlete. On one hand, it pays for your education. You're very grateful and thankful for that. On the other, it basically says to you, unless you're somebody who doesn't get any sleep or is extraordinarily talented academically, that it's going to be almost impossible for you to pursue certain kinds of majors. So I think there's that sort of thing. I would also say that I think our student athletes, relative to race, many of them have come out of circumstances and backgrounds and a national culture where the ease of interaction in athletics for people from different racial and cultural backgrounds is a lot better now than it was 20 or 30 years ago.
Kevin Cole is a member of the NCAA national champion lacrosse team. He has a question, but I want to ask him a question first. During the season, how many hours a week do you as a student athlete have to spend on your sport?
Daily, it probably averages around getting to and from practice probably about 4 hours a day. And then there's, of course, the time for film and preparation, conditioning, workouts. So that can dramatically increase as you get closer to the game on Saturday. So anywhere from probably 3 to 4 hours a week, or a day, excuse me.
What is your question?
I just have a question for both of the speakers. With the development of the internet, what kind of challenges does that pose to the administration, the athletic administration and the administration of the school in protecting the athletes, from organizations such as MySpace or the Facebook?
Let me just say that, first of all, there are two weekly magazines, print magazines, newspapers, that come out totally devoted to Notre Dame athletics. And they're not yet trying to sift their way through grade school prospects, but that day is soon coming. In fact, if a medical school could develop a way of cloning so that the child would have gigantic hands or extremely long arms or everybody would have great twitch muscles or whatever, I'm sure somebody would come along saying that's a great idea. The internet, it seems to me, its great advantage is its freedom of interaction. Its great disadvantage is fact-checking, that is rumor-mongering titillating details about people's lives, and the fact that if you're a student athlete and you get in any trouble at all, it's instantaneously national news, even though the average student, that's not the case. All we have to do is think about a certain school south of here and a certain program that's been in the national news for, a year or so, much to everybody's disadvantage who was involved in what otherwise would have been a set of internal procedures, perhaps that it would have gone to the criminal courts as well.
I tend to respond to that question with regard to Father Malloy's comments about when an athlete is identified as an athlete and the impact that has on you individually. And I suspect that when you were in the seventh or eighth grade, it became apparent to your coaches and to others around you that you had some skills that not everybody had. And what I saw began to happen, and I've watched it through the years, is that maybe it's not intentional, but there's a form of preferential treatment that begins to fall into place. And if you're a player, you end up in high school not having any afternoon classes. That's when you have study hall, because you can be free to go shoot around or do whatever you do in your sport. The newspaper people want to talk to you, and the television people. You show up on the internet. You have a pep rally. I've yet to see a pep rally for a high school academic club or dance group. But you're 16 years old, and there are all the students in the high school clapping you because you play linebacker or center or catcher or something on the baseball team. And all that's wonderful, except for, the potential emotional damage that it does to the individual, where preferential treatment becomes an expectation. And each level you move up the ladder in sports, the more preference, the more the accolades, the more attention that you receive. And then the interesting thing is, and the thing you have to be prepared for, is the day that you stop, it stops. I mean, it is over instantly. Your jokes are not funny. I mean, they're just not. They're not funny anymore. Nobody picks up the tab at lunch, you know, supper. It's an amazing thing. So I really do worry about the individuals, and we've actually put in place at Ole Miss a freshman course for athletes who have not been in that kind of environment before, to try to help them understand what the behavioral expectations are. And then the NCAA has something called Living Skills that tries to prepare athletes for life after athletics.
I took a course recently from Gene Corrigan in which he referred to the practice of the university asking for donations in order to allow you to apply for tickets, season tickets, as scalping, which I would agree with. But I would also say it's a form of gambling, because for many of those tickets, you're not told how much you have to give, and you may or may not be allowed to buy tickets. I'm interested in your thoughts.
You want me to respond?
Go ahead.
I mentioned and at most places, is what we call an auxiliary, and it is self-supporting. Our budget at the University of Mississippi is small compared to others in the Southeastern Conference. Our budget is $33 million a year. Athletics has to generate $33 million. In order to do that, the seating priority and the parking priority and then the opportunity to have breakfast with a coach all take on value. And so the schools that are trying to keep up in what has now been labeled the arms race with facilities and salaries, appearances, travel arrangements, everything about the athletics program, are having to look for every legitimate source of revenue that's available. And so were it a different time and were the culture different, we could just all show up at a stadium and watch a game or a basketball match. But With the money driving that whole enterprise the way it is, I don't know how schools are going to avoid that. I will say one thing about charitable contributions, and he knows a lot more about it than I do, but it's been my experience at our university that academic charitable contributions are much easier to attract than athletics contributions. There's a quid pro quo mentality with athletics gifts. If I give you $2,000, I can buy 4 tickets on the 30, or I can sit at the courtside. And if I give you 5, I'll get a parking pass close to the stadium. If I give you 10, then I get to go to breakfast with a coach. I mean, that's been my experience. Whereas for the library, people give out of the love that they have for the university.
During my time at Notre Dame, we expanded the stadium from 59,000 to 81,000. And I was not going to do it until a faculty group came along saying this was a good thing. And we had a process, a strategic planning process. And the group that proposed that said this was desirable for multiple reasons that made sense to them. And one of the reasons was in order to attract a higher level of support for the academic enterprise. So one reason why a ticket accessibility for adults is connected often to being part of the giving alumni or friends of the university, and special treatment is given to those who have been major donors, is that that money is redirected into other high priorities of the institution. But it is also the case that the free television available, I shouldn't say free because you have to pay for cable in a sense, allows anyone to watch games across the country that would otherwise be unavailable. So there's a subsidy that fans have watching games that they wouldn't otherwise have a chance to see firsthand.
I'd like to stay on the theme of money with my question also. We've seen instances recently where football coaches and basketball coaches are brought into institutions, but the salaries they receive are actually more from outside than from the university itself. And conversely, we've seen coaches bought out recently from outside alumni organizations. The contract is with the university, but do you feel like you're really in charge of your football and basketball coaches?
I think we are, but it is a precarious relationship, and the more money one spends in luring a coach to come in a high-profile program, and the more that we are dependent on others to help provide the subsidy to make that available, the more they won't have a say in the future, in future hirings or in determination of the success or failure of the coach and of the program. If you say that the university's total athletic budget is X, and you look at the reported salary of a high-profile football or basketball coach, and it looks like 25% of X, you then have to figure out where in the heck is the, how are you going to afford that if it keeps escalating? And then if all major coaches have rollover contracts in order to keep them from either the professional ranks or from other schools stealing them away, and if one of the prices you have to pay to get a coach who's successful somewhere else is to buy out that protective contract, then you start to see the level of cost in the game to find the perfect Messiah coach.
The contract issue that you mentioned, in our particular case at a state university, the coach actually has, there are actually two contracts. One is with the state of Mississippi, and our football coach is paid $900,000. He is paid $200,000 from the state of Mississippi from his state contract, which is funded by self-generated revenue from the athletics department. The other $700,000 is paid from gifts made to our University of Mississippi Athletics Association Foundation. And that's where that conflict of interest issue starts to get, I think, a little bit, makes me anxious.
Let me say one more thing. It isn't simply what the head coach gets paid. Look at a picture of a typical male or female basketball program, the total entourage 20 or 30 years ago, and look at it now. Look at a football program and look at it now. And that's, of course, been refracted down through the whole system of athletics. You look at a typical basketball bench, since I was used to sitting on the bench, there's not any room anymore. There are so many non-players on the bench. Now, that's a great job opportunity, in a sense, but it also is one of the reasons for the escalation in the overall cost.
Dr. Kayak, from your position in academia, how would you respond to the perception that is fostered by the media, the newspapers, the magazines, the television sports center programs, that the system for determining a national collegiate football championship is egregiously faulty, but that a system of a playoff system, which most people believe would be fairer, is violently opposed by university and college presidents?
I had the Let's see. I heard a person say one time that he must have been being punished for an unknown sin by God for being put on the BCS Oversight Committee. we did that, and we struggled with that whole process. And the presidents were, I didn't hear a president speak for a playoff. And the reasons given were, and I like to give this one first because people laugh at it. We actually have classes. Yeah, you know, kids go to school, and so that's one thing. The second semester begins, and school begins. Football season is long. It starts in late July, and the kids have been working out all year, and then they have an intensive football season, and then it ends the first weekend in January. If you extend it with playoffs, then you find yourself going into mid or late January, and by then the basketball players have taken the courts, and we are back in school. And the boys who play football who've been bruised or mending and getting ready for spring practice. And so scheduling had a lot to do with it. Concern for academic, protecting the academic opportunities of students had a lot to do with that decision. And then I mentioned in my earlier remarks that the Final Four has just been a great example of why a playoff doesn't seem to satisfy this desire for more and greater definition. I remember when there were eight teams in the Final Four, and then 16, and then 32, and then 64, and now there's 65. And so if we have a playoff, who's going to say who the top four teams are and how do you get there? That's one concern. Another one is that we have 29 bowls. Every community who sponsors a bowl, they are seriously invested in the bowl program as an economic development activity and as a way of presenting their cities to the world. And so the bowls don't want to be diminished in value by having a multi-layered playoff system. In the Southeastern Conference, we have a championship game. So we play the 12-game season, and then we play a championship game in early December. And that game is sold out in June before anybody knows who's going to play in it. So it's a real popular game, and the Southeastern Conference openly and selfishly doesn't want to diminish the value of that. So I guess those are the multiple answers. They may not be adequate. They may not satisfy the people who are proponents of the playoffs system, but I haven't seen any presidential support for a playoff system in football.
I never supported it, but one more answer would be, at the end of the bowl season, half the coaches and half the fans are happy. In a playoff, only one team is happy.
I have a question about academics. I was fortunate enough, I was a faculty member at the University of Texas, and I got to serve on one of the faculty oversight committees of athletics that you were talking about. And recently, probably the biggest topic we've talked about is the APR. And I was wondering whether you thought that that is a step in the right direction for the academic integrity that you have been seeking for athletics.
I think the answer to that has a lot to do with the nature of the institution. Now, a school like UVA, which is considered one of the flagship state campuses in the country and a great source of pride for the state, and legitimately so, and a campus like my own, which is a very selective private, our expectations for our student body, as far as progress to graduation, progress through the first year, eligible for the second, progress within a major each year, each semester, and progress to graduation with your class are very high, because that's what our expectation is for the student body as a whole. But there are a lot of institutions that have a different mission and a different responsibility. And so then the question is, what sort of academic profile would they need to be eligible, and what kind of academic performance would be suitable to be able to continue to compete? I think there's no easy answer to that. But the evaluation system now that we have available punishes schools which are not graduating a certain percentage of their student athletes. And I think there's good reason for putting the pressure on, but it would be hard to argue in certain institutions why the level of standard should be so much higher for student athletes than it is for the student body as a whole.
our experience has been that the culture has changed among the coaches at our university. They're much more sensitive to the abilities of the student athletes to be able to make satisfactory progress and graduate. So we're seeing a higher level of performance and a much, much increased level of sensitivity by our coaches to that academic progress rule.
I'm a member of the faculty here at the University of Virginia, and I'm a great athletic supporter and go to games and all that sort of stuff. Some of my colleagues are not as enthusiastic about athletics in the university. I don't know, I wouldn't give a number how many fall in either camp, but I think here at the university, one of the things that's been very helpful to us is we have a very strong outreach from the athletic department to the faculty, and I think Craig Littlepage is doing a wonderful job there. And I'm wondering at your universities and your observations of a successful athletic program, how does the athletic department react and relate to the faculty?
Let me say about Craig that he was on one of the NCAA groups that I served on, and a terrific representative. So you should be very proud of him as athletic director. I'll leave that. You go ahead and talk about the rest.
Well, again, as most things, the answer to that question depends on your leadership. If you have a director of athletics who's really sensitive to faculty involvement and faculty support, you seem to see, we see a higher level of faculty participation. I've actually tried to keep up with the ticket purchase patterns of our faculty. And about 70% of our faculty buy tickets, and we discount them to 50% price for faculty. So there's a good level of faculty interest. And of course, then we have one group who have no interest whatsoever, one group who are quite cynical about the whole process. But on the whole, we're small enough, I guess, 14,000 students, for the community to interact a lot and for athletics to be pretty closely tied to the academic community. But as athletics has become more specialized and more demands are made on players and coaches, there's less interaction among faculty and athletics people than there was 15 years ago. And I don't like the trend. I'd much rather see it.
Our present athletic director, Kevin White, has a doctorate, and he teaches a course about athletics in the business school, which is very popular, and that's one vehicle. We honor distinguished faculty at half times of football games and at basketball games, and we often invite people from the faculty to sit on the bench, which has no seats left, but anyway, and those kinds of interactions. So I think there are efforts underway, but it's a challenge for all of us.
My question is also related to academics. Miles Brand and the NCAA are sponsoring a colloquium next January as part of their convention to examine whether intercollegiate athletics is worthy of academic exploration, scholarly work. Wondering if you think it ought to be a focus, and if so, what value it would be to study college sports.
One of the things that I am characterized by is I've always been a huge reader, and now that I've stepped down as president, I've escalated the reading agenda, and I've always been a reader among other things, in the literature of higher education, and also the literature on sports, including intercollegiate athletics. I think it's a huge area for research and exploration, simply as a cultural phenomenon, no less the influence and impact it has on our campuses and on those who come through the system. So I'm eager to have talented faculty members take this on as a part of the research agenda.
I can't add to that. I agree.
Our closing question will come from Raleigh Ann Blank, who is chair of the Student Judiciary Committee.
And it won't pertain to that, thankfully enough. But that said, a little precursor to my question. I know Jason Kane and the rest of the basketball team had a chance to go to Walter Reed this Tuesday before their game against Maryland, and congratulations on the win. But that said, how important is community involvement for student athletes to not only the positivity of the program, but the university as a whole?
I think it's a wonderful dimension of the educational experience. one of the things that I try to say as frequently as possible is that a great deal of the educational experience goes on in the classroom or the laboratory or the library or the computer lab, but a lot of it goes on outside the classroom. And when you're dealing with emotional and social and spiritual, physical development and intellectual development, then you're dealing with a whole person. And so to the extent that athletes can be involved in community service programs, and there's a lot of that, and a lot of recognition for athletes being involved in those programs, it seems to me to be beneficial to everybody.
We have a position in our athletic department structure to foster this sort of activity, and they often work with the captains of the individual teams and identify ways that are compatible with the schedules and all to go out and be involved. And when we played in the bowl game this year in New Orleans, there was an effort to try to not only with the football team, but also our alumni organizations to go out and do service in that much troubled city. So I think there are wonderful examples of that, and the more of it, the better.
One of the close, both personal and institutional friends of the Miller Center is Dan Jordan, who leads the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, owns and operates Monticello. He and Gene Corrigan suggested a couple of months ago that this program would be a great idea, and since Dan Jordan is an Ole Miss grad, he offered to midwife the program. He said this would be a great idea, and I agree with him, and I thank him, and I thank Monk Malloy and Dr. Kayat. Thank you. Thank you.